Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us, virtual audience, and thank you all for coming out tonight. This is the publication party for Rhys Bowen's new Her Royal Spinous book called Peril in Paris. And what's really interesting is that it doesn't publish till next week because of the paper and printing disasters and so forth that have overtaken publishing. But when they told us that, I pointed out to them that we'd had this date booked for a long time and we didn't have any dates next week. And so they finally said, which was really surprising, that we could go ahead and do it tonight. And then we have to put the books away. We can't sell them until next Tuesday.
But if you have one tonight, you can sneak out with it.
and you have bragging rights because you were here legitimately for it.
Yeah.
Publishers actually do have what they call lay-down dates in bookstores if they behave badly and let books out, can be banned from hosting authors and doing other stuff. So we try to be reasonably careful. But anyway, we have sanction for tonight. So it's so good to see you again.
Yes. Well, an in-person event, you know.
I know.
We've forgotten what they look like, you know.
We really have.
I mean, we did one in the spring when Claire and I had the Molly Murphy book out, and that was nice, and that's the only other one I've done. So.
Well, yeah. And we have a chance because you have another book out in March, right?
We do, yeah. Yep. Next March, be there.
We'll try to sort that out, right. So anyway, it's lovely to see you all back, and let's talk about Georgie going to Paris. But before she goes to Paris, why don't you tell us what's going on with her? Because there's some interesting things going on in her life.
Yeah. No, so who already is familiar with Lady Georgie and her particular... Oh, okay. Is anybody like to be caught up or are we quite happy as where we are? Okay. Well, at the end of the last book called God Rest Ye Royal Gentlemen, which took place at Sandringham, at the Royal Estate at Sandringham at Christmas time. And, of course, the big event was that King George V, at the end of the book, is going to pass away. We knew that he'd been quite sick for some time, and his son is called back from skiing in Switzerland with his lady friend, who should be nameless. So they come back, and we learn at the end of the book that the king has actually passed away. And
there's a famous phrase for that. The king's life is moving slowly.
Moving peacefully to a close.
Yeah, either slowly or peacefully to a close. It was given out, if I remember right, in order for the BBC. They timed it for a BBC announcement.
Yeah, I think they gave him a little injection or something.
To sort of help him out his way in order to. Yeah. And, you know, if you paid any attention to what went on around the death of Queen Elizabeth, there were journalists like posed everywhere. Yeah. All over the world, waiting for an official confirmation.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing was I was in London when she died, and we'd just arrived about an hour before, and we were with my other daughter and son-in-law. They went out for lunch, and they came back, and as Jane came in the door, her phone got a ping, and my phone got a ping, and it says the Queen has died, and she looked up at me. She said, "The Queen's died," so they went down to Buckingham Palace and they saw the flowers starting to be put there and everything. And the next day I had to go for a lunch with someone who's doing the TV series of Constable Evans. And it was in Piccadilly. And as I walked down, all of the, Fortnum and Mason, all those beautiful shops there had their windows draped in black. And they had a big sign outside, saying Her Majesty the Queen, blah, blah, blah. Some of the shops had a sign on saying, "We will be closed during the period of mourning," which was 10 days. And that's rather impressive, I thought. And then all the bells in London were tolling once a minute, bong.
Really?
You could just hear this bong everywhere you went. So the whole of London, then of course the whole of the world. The thing that really touched me the most was when they showed Dodger Stadium and 100,000 people standing for a minute of silence, and there was complete silence. I thought, this is someone who's really respected. And it was everybody in England was taking it really personally. And I got, the funny thing was, they know I write this series. I got so many messages saying, "I am so sorry for your loss." Like, well, actually, I'm deeply touched by the Queen, but, and then I said too, and I thought about it and I said, I'm not sorry at all. What a wonderful way to go. The day before, she'd received the new prime minister at Balmoral, where she's very happy. And she'd been perfectly, awake and alert and everything at Balmoral the day before. She had Anne and Charles were both there. And she just, and the corgis, yeah. And she just literally went at the right time, I think, because imagine going with your full faculties and not in hooked up to any, no pain, yeah. And obviously she's missing Philip. She's very lonely.
Yeah, I thought when he died that she would have a very hard time going out there. It was interesting. I did the book launch for Lord Geoffrey Archer, as I did last year. And so he was in London, and he knew her, and he actually did a lot of work with Princess Diana, but he has a lot of association with the royal family. And before we started, we both looked at each other, and he said, I thought she'd go to 100. And I said, so did I.
Yeah.
Really did, And it was,
She might have wanted to outdo her mum, who was, 103?
I think she was 101.
Oh,
but
was she?
I sort of thought that she might, because she liked round numbers, and I thought that she might go to 100.
Yeah. But I think especially because of COVID, she was so isolated. She was there alone at Windsor. The thing that really touched me, you remember his funeral?
Yep.
And she's sitting all alone without anybody to sort of put a hand or just comfort or anything. So maybe it was the right time for her.
Well, whether it was or not, that's what happened.
Well, I tell you another interesting thing. A friend who's a nurse said to me she's been on an IV. Because the back of her hand
My doctor at Mayo said the same thing that she didn't attend a lot of the 70th year jubilee. So it may have been that she did have something going on and that, you know, they didn't acknowledge it.
Yeah.
It's not like the Pope, the Pope can't be autopsied. So that's why there was all that rumor. No, seriously. Remember the one that died so soon after he was?
Yeah,
right.
John Paul
the First, and there was a lot of conversation about whether something, sinister had happened. But because they'd never answered that. But I sort of felt like it was also true.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that the royal family. No, I don't think so. That would be my impression. And they were very close-mouthed about, they just said she died, like King George, life moved peacefully towards his close.
Yeah.
And then it only came out much later that they gave him just in order to make, as I understand it, they did that so he would die in time for the BBC announcement, which sounds a little cold-blooded, but, on the other hand.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you hold on for 15 minutes, please?
Yeah. Right. Well, let's go back to Georgie.
It was so similar to, what we've been talking about. Now, so Georgie, at the end of that book, we know that King George V has died and that the Prince of Wales had become Edward VIII. But we also find out that Georgie, who's been feeling a little bit of out of sorts, is pregnant. So now we're looking forward to a baby. And they've also got two puppies, which is another incidental thing. But so life has changed quite a lot for Georgie. As you know, she's now living in her godfather's very nice house. He's away climbing mountains, as he normally is. And so Georgie and Darcy are happily settled now and looking forward to a baby. And the first 3 months have been rather rough. She said really bad morning sickness. And she's not felt that well. And now suddenly spring has come and she feels a lot better. And life looks very hopeful. So when her husband says to her, would you like to go to Paris? She thinks that's rather a good idea.
Well, let's be fair. She's a little bored. And her grandfather, whom she really loves, is not terribly comfortable in this more formal manor house setting. And he wants to go back to his little London home.
Yeah.
He is the grandfather from her mother's side, not the royal side.
Yeah.
And then there's Queenie, whose food is not necessarily, it's a little stodgy for whatever. Mm-hmm. So the thought of going to Paris just to eat would be would be seriously appealing, right? Croissant, café au lait, the whole bit.
Yeah. And Georgie's never really been. She's been she's been through Paris because she was at finishing school in Switzerland. So as you know, you get the boat train across to Paris, then you have to go from the Gare du Nord to the Gare de Lyon before you go on to Switzerland. So she's crossed Paris by taxi, but she's never really had the funds or anything to explore Paris. So this is really nice for her.
It is nice for her. But then the question of why does Darcy actually want to go or need to go to Paris comes up. And, you know, we don't really have any idea what he actually does, do
we?
No.
No. Yeah, we have lots of ideas.
We can speculate, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And then you remember he tricked her once before. I mean, not tricked her, but when he said, let's go to Kenya on our honeymoon. Yeah, that was wonderful. Because it turned out when someone says to him, thank God you've come, it's like, well, is this not a honeymoon that I'm thinking it's going to be? And there might be something in Paris, too, that Darcy might have an ulterior motive for being there. But Georgie is going to stay with her friend Belinda. And Belinda's got a flat in Paris at the moment. And she is, you know, she's always been interested in dress design. So she's working with Chanel to sort of hone her skills. Yeah, I'm really annoyed now that she's got a Chanel jacket on and I don't.
And pearls, because and that's pearls part too. Of the signature Chanel look. Right, yeah. Coco Chanel, I mean, her life is weirder than, stranger by far than fiction.
Yeah.
And, you know, she even survived collaborating with the Nazis during the Second World War, which, right? I mean, she's a very colorful, interesting woman.
Yeah, she is the ultimate survivor.
Truly.
You know, she was born in the gutter with nothing, and I think her parents put her in an orphanage for a while, and then she became apprenticed to a hat maker. Mm-hmm. And from there, she started designing really good hats for these ladies. And they thought, oh, this is nice. And so she just lit. And then she got the first of many men who helped lift her out of poverty. But she went right to the heights. She was the mistress of the Duke of Westminster. Winston Churchill adored her. And she went, you know, she had various men who were very powerful and very rich. And so she really established herself. Until World War II, of course, then she had a suite of apartments at the Ritz, where all the German officers were, and she was the mistress of a high German officer. And then the amazing thing was after the war, when all the other collaborators were tarred and feathered and shoved into jail, she just drifted along very nicely.
I know. I found that really incredible.
Very incredible, yeah.
But, you know, we can see that sometimes people who really are famous or have lots of money or whatever manage to get away with things that regular
You've
people...
You've noticed that recently,
I really
you?
Have. I really have. And, you know, I had to laugh because I did taught a class yesterday at the Barrett Honors College at ASU. And I said to the dean when they invited me, I said, the only two things I can talk about are aging gracefully in a small business. And there actually is a corollary there, which is that, you know, if you stay busy and engaged, you will age more gracefully. And she said, that's what these are incoming, so they're very young. You know, that's what they need to hear. So I was trying to explain to them that life is really about a series of choices that you make, and then it's also about what happens to you. And, you know, you can get derailed. And so I just read in the Wall Street Journal about the senior executives of Twitter who thought they had great jobs and they had thought they had golden parachutes and the whole bit. And Elon Musk came in and overnight they were all out of work, whatever. And I pointed out to the kids that, you know, if you work for a publicly traded company, you don't have any power at all, you know, or even in a private company unless you own it. And that, you know, you probably they'd made a good choice, you know, for what they were interested in to work for Twitter.
Yeah.
But now what? And, you know, it's hard to explain that to 20-year-olds, right? That that you don't really have control over all these things.
No, I mean, well, you think go back to my father's generation. He worked for one company all his life.
Right.
And he went right after school to start there. And he ran a paper factory, and he ran that paper factory, apart from the war, he ran that paper factory until he retired. And, you know, that was
When I was in high school in the 1950s, the sort of dream job was to get a job at IBM and put in your 30 years, and then you'd retire and move to Sun City. I'm serious, you know. And I said, you know, I found it really interesting. I was doing some kind of, I don't remember what for, Merriam-Webster entered 370-some brand new words into the dictionary last year, words that did not exist until last year. That is the rate at which, you know, everything is accelerating and changing You know, think of the words you use today. Would you have used emailed as a verb 20 years ago? When I started the bookstore, you know, we printed out the book news and we folded it and we put labels on it
and
we carted it to the post office. And at one point, I had Nevada Barr and who was it? Nevada Barr and Dana Stabenow and Lisa Scottolini and I were sitting on the floor in my house. We were talking, but we were also putting stickers on the book news and all. And Lisa looked around and he said, you know, what are we doing? But that was, that's where we are. And then think about, today when everything is electronic and flashing along.
I mean, look at the iPhone. I was thinking about that the other day. You do everything on your phone now.
You can't travel if you don't have a phone.
No,
it's impossible to even go through an airport at this point without a phone.
We took the channel and you come to the channel, you go like this and you walk in. It's, it's amazing.
I know. Yeah. I'm still sort of scared of it. So I cling to my husband and moments like that. I still want him to print out the boarding pass, the paper one.
That's what John does. He prints out everything. Yeah.
I feel happier with a real copy.
Backup. Yeah.
Right.
So he carries this great big folder with everything in. And we get to the station and he starts, wait a minute, let me get the folder out. And I go, bonk, 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 we're through.
Yes, it works out that way. Anyway, Belinda is working at Chanel and Georgie, and I really feel for her about this because she's beginning to show. She's, what, 5 months along?
5 months along, yes.
Right. Yeah. And so she doesn't have any clothes that actually fit at this point, and she doesn't really have the money, to buy anything. So if she has got to go and meet Belinda at Chanel, this is going to be an agonizing moment, right? Uh-huh. Pretty embarrassing.
Yeah.
But I like the way you solved it.
Yeah. Well, luckily, her friend Zuzu happens to be in Paris.
Oh, another coincidence.
Yeah, what a coincidence. Yeah. You know, Zuzu was always popping across in her little plane anyway. So Georgie does have Zuzu, and she also has a mummy. And that's the interesting twist, I think, on this one, is we're seeing various aspects of Paris. We're seeing Chanel and the very rich. And then we're seeing Belinda's building in the attic. There's the archetypal struggling American writer. And so Georgie goes with him to one of these cafes where, and I really, something I was in Paris 3 weeks, 4 weeks ago, I really envy that it really existed, that you'd meet these artists and writers in a cafe and you'd sit down and you'd talk passionately about art and music and everything. Doesn't exist anymore, does it?
No.
I mean, it's sad.
It's
all
tweets.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I meet other writers sometimes and we do discuss sometimes, but it's not the same as, I mean, I said, I really wish that, I could have sat there with Hemingway, but he might have said, your work is so trivial compared to mine, that and then I might have kicked him. So,
Well, life was lived at a slower pace, Reese.
Yeah.
And you also were not constantly on call. I left my phone by accident in the car before I went over to Barrett yesterday. I felt really nervous. I felt sort of naked. And, because we're so used now to that instantaneous contact and people panic if you don't reply, right away.
Yeah.
And we're now tethered. So we don't really have the leisure to sit around for 2 or 3 hours over coffee and chat anymore.
No. I mean, the nice thing in Paris, which still exists, is you can sit there with a coffee and chat for hours and nobody's going to come and bring you the bill unless you ask for it. You can buy one coffee and no one sort of says, well, you need to move out of that seat now. Yeah. The one thing I did do in Paris was to have coffee with Cara Black, who's my friend and who happened to be there at the same time. So she and I met for coffee one afternoon, which was nice. I was supposed to be going. Another friend, Louise Penny, has just bought an apartment there and she wanted to show me her new apartment. But then right before she was supposed to come, her brother arrived in London. And so she was stuck with her brother in London instead. So,
did you get, this is a real diversion, forgive me for this, but did you actually get to go and look at Notre Dame and see what was going on?
Yeah, I did. And that's really interesting because if you see the front of Notre Dame, it looks fine. It looks completely untouched. And you go around to the sides and these enormous scaffolding with the stairs going up probably, 25, 30 stairs going up and there's no sides. The sides have gone, you can see a bit of the buttress here and there, but then, it's virtually held up with a scaffolding around the sides. And I talked to a tour guide in Paris,
And she said they're working really hard to get it all finished in time for the Olympics in 2024. And she said, and we think they're cutting corners. So it'll be interesting to see what they do.
Yeah. Well, the stone for the cathedral was actually quarried underneath Paris in those limestone quarries. That is the reason there are catacombs under Paris.
Yeah.
And the heat for limestone is disastrous. So there was a real chance that the whole thing would fall down because of the tremendous heat.
Yeah.
So are they quarrying? Well, you don't know, obviously.
I don't know,
but they're either quarrying new stone or maybe they're trying to treat the stone, you know, to get it back in shape.
No, I was amazed how little of the sides are there. You know, you've got scaffolding, you've got these great towers of scaffolding, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and all the way down.
Yeah. Well, it's not the first time the cathedrals have burned. When I was in York many, many years ago, they'd had a terrible fire and the rose window had shattered. And, you know, it was all down and they were the medieval glass and the whole bit. So cathedrals, actually, they're candles a little bit. There's lightning.
Yeah.
Can happen.
Yeah.
But I do hope. It was such a shock when that happened.
Yeah, no, it was horrible. Yeah.
Right. But Georgie would have seen Notre Dame as
she
it is.
She was taken to Notre Dame, yes.
And the Louvre without the weird glass dome.
Yes.
Right.
No, Georgie had a lovely time being taken around Paris, mainly by this struggling writer. And I think she enjoyed that more than Chanel. She finds very terrifying because Chanel herself is quite terrifying. And they're about to have the fall collection. It's spring, so you have the fall collection's going to be released. And so everybody's in complete panic at Chanel. And Chanel grabs Georgie and suggests that she might design an outfit for her very rapidly that she could model. And, of course, you know, Georgie had one disaster modeling a few books ago and never again. So, it's going to be this very big fashion show and everybody who's anybody is going to be there, including some people we know and love and people we don't know and we know and don't love. So we'll have to see.
And that's probably all we can tell you about the plot. But there are a lot of really interesting threads, I think, that you wove together in this particular story.
I think one of the threads is this is a light series, obviously, but the backstory of sort of what's going on in Europe has gradually crept in a bit more as the series has gone along. You know, and Mummy, of course, lives in Germany with this German man who she's going to marry. And she has come across with some other German women to do some shopping and to go to Chanel. And we find that she has a minder. Where she goes is a rather severe-looking woman who just happens to be watching her. And that, you know, Georgie is now getting worried that Mummy should not stay in Germany any longer. And so we'll see what happens in future books there.
So that brings up an interesting point. You know, French women are just built differently physically. They can wear Chanel. German women often aren't. and, you know, and I thought it was kind of interesting in a way that, you know, they would come thinking that maybe they would wear Paris fashion. But, you know, I've never been able to wear it. You have to have long, thin arms. And, you know, it's just a body type that, you know, that I don't have.
And very masculine in many ways. I mean, she designed a lot of suits that were essentially men's suits, you know. And,
Yep. So anyway, you sort of hint around about that, but I did think it was kind of interesting that these, you know, the German, the Nazi leaders' wives would come to buy new wardrobes in Paris, and the odds were poor that the clothes were going to fit.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So
well, the other thing is French women can wear scarves. Have you noticed
that? How did they do it?
I don't know. They take a scarf and they just throw it over one shoulder and it looks perfect. I bought a sweater and I tried it on. And she said, oh, now, madame, you need the scarf to go with it. And she came and she put it around my shoulder and it looked really nice. And she said, there you are. And I said, you don't understand. I'm not French. The moment I walk out of this room, it's going to fall off.
Hmm. It's really true.
It's so true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have an Hermes scarf, which is absolutely beautiful, and I've had it for like 35 years. I have never figured out how to wear it. I have I've tried everything, and it always looks just like messy.
Yeah.
No, it's so discouraging.
Perhaps they have lessons in school, you know, where we're not going to study the scarf putting on, you know.
I know. It seems to be an intrinsic kind of
thing.
Yeah, it
is. They just know how to do it. The same.
So just a word about Darcy. Georgie, because they stay in a hotel together for one night when they get to Paris, and then she moves to Belinda at Darcy's urging, and then he kind of disappears. And Georgie really worries about what's going on. We won't tell you what is going on, but nonetheless, at some point, are you going to have to, do you think, give him more of an out? I mean, you're going to out him a little bit more?
I think we've outed him fairly much now, in that we know by the end of this book what he was supposed to be doing.
Right.
So we know, but I think he doesn't want, he's been offered a desk job. And, you know, part of him wants to take it because he wants the security to take care of her. I mean, they're living in someone's house for free, which is very nice. But, I think he'd like to have enough money so they can get a nanny when there's a baby and all that sort of thing. But then he likes the freedom of being asked to go to Buenos Aires and do something sneaky, you know? So who knows?
Well, but I mean, there's the whole British thing. You cast your mind towards Lord Peter Wimsey, let's say, or Mr. Campion. You know, they had money. So the question of Scotland Yard ever, like, actually hiring Lord Peter Wimsey never came into play. He could afford to swan about and, you know, court Lady Harriet and do all sorts of things. Mr. Campion was the same way. So there were many people who filled roles in British government that were not salaried because they didn't need to be. It was considered kind of an obligation of the, you know, of the upper moneyed class to do things like, you know, spying or diplomatic missions. Those of you who read Tasha Alexander will know that Lady Emily's husband, whom I think they're a wonderful couple, he too is kind of a secret agent.
Yeah.
But he has an income and the whole bit of his own. So, you know, there's always been that kind of moneyed amateur.
Yeah. Well, when you
role.
Think that in England, I don't know if it's still now, but all the time I was growing up, the justice of the peace was the local magistrate. And they had, if you, minor offences like being drunk and disorderly and things and stealing, you know, poaching from someone's land or something, you'd appear before three magistrates. They were all moneyed, titled people locally, and none of them were paid. They'd do this. They, you know, it was their what one did. One did one's bit for the
right.
You know,
but
community.
Darcy doesn't fall into that category.
No,
he doesn't have you know, an income of his own.
He has the credentials, but not the money to go with them.
Yep, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So that'll be fun to see how you go. So we are obviously in. King George died at the very beginning of 1936, and Edward VIII, if you remember the arc of that year, he abdicated in December of 1936. Yeah. He was never, there was no coronation. He was never actually crowned.
No.
So you've got a year to write yourself through at this point.
Yeah, and also, I mean, the time that I'm, this is April into May, nobody in England knows about Mrs. Simpson. He wants to marry her. Her divorce is being finalized at this time. She is determined to marry him, but nobody in England, because the press have this secret agreement that they won't mention her. And then in the summer, the next book I'm just starting to write now, in the summer, he goes off with her on a yacht for a month or two and just, you know, leaves his duties. He's essentially he's Peter Pan. He wants to play. He does not want to be king. He never wanted to be king, and you know King George before he died said the boy will ruin the monarchy within a year. And there you are.
Well, I think also if you lots of studies of Mrs. Simpson, she wanted to be queen.
Yeah.
I don't know that she really wanted to marry him. And in fact, her punishment was that she did marry him. And then, I'm serious, had to then live with him. There was no way back once it happened. But
well, I mean, she was this smart, calculating woman in many ways. But then how naive. She really believed that when he became king, he could just proclaim, you know, I have changed the rules and you will now be queen. And she thought that would happen, not realizing that the Church of England not recognizing divorce.
Right.
There's no way she could ever marry him and be queen. So.
Yep. Yeah. So
Yeah.
Hence Camilla's sort of strange title. You know, she's not
queen consort.
Right.
Yeah. Which is interesting because we always thought before that he would be king and she would remain Duchess of Cornwall.
Right.
That's what it and then the Queen Elizabeth decreed before she died that Camilla was to be known as queen consort, which was a very nice thing for her to do, I think, because Camilla wasn't that popular, although she behaved incredibly well during the whole death of the queen and everything. She was absolutely the rock, you know, that got everything going.
I was interested to read that actually Philip was not known as Prince Philip. He was remained the Duke of Edinburgh after they were married, after she became queen. And he had some questionable company at one point on a yacht, one of those, you know, bad association things. And rather than have him called to testify in a messy divorce, which was going to overtake one of these people, by elevating him to become Prince Philip, he could no longer be subpoenaed and go to court. And so I thought maybe that was why she did it. Maybe she learned, you know, from that.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that was interesting with him was that she never made him Prince Consort, which Prince Albert was to, which meant, you know, the Prince Consort of Queen Victoria meant that he was in an advisory capacity.
Right.
So Philip never got that. So it was always quite clear that she was the queen and he was two paces behind.
Yeah. Well, they were married for over 70 years, however it worked out. So, you know, there we go.
No, I think their last years, I think they were very much dependent on each other and you know, enjoyed each other's company, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, anybody have questions? We probably said all we can say about Georgie at this point and Paris.
We can't tell you who did what and why. And
that's true.
Yeah.
No?
Do you have any questions you'd like? Yes. George's father, he died.
I mean,
grandfather. He's in the beginning of this book, and he goes. He goes home back to his little house in London because he's been staying with Georgie, and he feels very uncomfortable in that house. He's not used to being waited on. You know, where does he belong? He's not a servant, so he can't go down and chat with the servants. But he doesn't like being waited on either. So he wants to go back to his little house where he knows where he is. But he's around at the beginning of the book, and he will come into the next book. So I'm not getting rid of him. I love him. He's one of my favorite characters.
He's wonderful. But isn't the lady next door kind of now out of the picture? Didn't we?
Yes, she died in a few months.
That was it, right. So there was some danger for a while that Georgie might have a difficult...
A terrible
step-grandmother. But
there's also the housekeeper at the house is... he quite likes her, I think, so that might turn into something, you know.
Might be prompting.
That would be nice.
Yep, and there's a, we won't tell you what, but there's a new hire at the end of this book that might also upend things slightly, too.
I was
in favor of that. Sounded good to me.
Yeah,
Patrick, you're looking like you might have some questions from the audience.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all right. You speak up.
Ah, yes, I'll repeat the question. Do I watch The Crown and how accurate is it? I think it's the basis of The Crown is accurate, and I think we've exaggerated for drama. So, you know, I think the scenes with Princess Margaret smashing everything and throwing everything and being drunk, I think she did like to drink a lot and she did do drugs. But, you know, everything to me just felt like a little over the top. And I'll be interested to see what they do with Diana and Charles's. I thought Diana and Charles was handled really quite well because you really got to feel for her as she was desperately trying to please him. And by doing that, doing completely the things that were wrong for him because he was so repressed and so didn't like any sort of show or drama. Remember, she dances for him with John Travolta and she does various things like that, which she thinks might please him and absolutely appalls him instead. So, you know, it just shows you how completely mismatched they were. And I've always felt that, the fact that, you know, 19-year-old girl straight out of a girl's boarding school, not that bright, not that educated, and she's with a 35-year-old man who is very much intellectual, very much into poetry, very much into gardening, all these things that she's not. And so, you know, it was a match that could never be. And then you have him always in love with Camilla. So, you know, you had a disaster waiting to happen. I mean, obviously it happened in every generation of royals before, that royals would marry someone they were told to marry. They'd produce the heirs, and then they'd say, okay, you know, you're free to do what you want now. The heir and the spare, you've got them, that's good. But so I thought the first one, the first episode, the first year of The Crown, I thought was excellent, because you got to see, I think Claire Foy really got the Queen perfectly, and you saw how she was struggling between doing what the job demanded of her and doing what, you know, she's a young woman, doing what she, her heart wanted her to do and what the job said she had to do. So I thought, I really got a feeling for that. As we've gone on, I don't think Olivia Colman got her quite as well, do you?
Well, I I don't watch it on principle, because I don't think they should be doing it while these people are alive, yeah. So I'm really offended by it. But I did think when Judi Dench came out and that Netflix then actually admitted that much of it wasn't true and that they had done it for dramatic effect.
Yeah.
And I have seen what that happened to another person, somebody I'm very fond of, who... Every story needs a villain, okay? Yeah. There's no good story, no, certainly, works without an antagonist. And I think that they're, in order to create a dramatic story, they end up villainizing people or exaggerating things. And then, unfortunately, many people take that as real.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, off it goes into, anyway.
No, Judi Dench was quite outspoken, wasn't she, on it?
Very. So, but Netflix then had to acknowledge publicly that they, in fact, that's what they had done, is that they had exaggerated and made things up.
Yeah. No, I have to say, I felt rather uneasy watching it, because those people were alive.
Exactly.
And, you know, how
one thing to
can
do
you
Victoria,
imagine turning on television, having your own life on with maybe Philip's infidelities exaggerated and things that might have happened in a small way, but being really exaggerated, be very uneasy, wouldn't it?
I thought she's a very dignified woman. I thought it was a really lousy thing to do while she was alive.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, onward. Patrick.
Yeah. Any more? Georgie traveled to South America. I would think probably not now, because she's going to be saddled with a baby. You know, I try to keep my characters not pregnant for as long as possible, because it's like having a dog. You know, you have to walk the dog every day, and if you have a child, you know, in those days they did leave them with nannies, as we know. But I don't think Georgie would want to do that. And when Molly Murphy had her baby, and then. She's sent to Paris too, because the house is bombed and she's threatened. And she arrives in Paris with this baby, and then there's this mystery that she's trying to solve. She's trying to solve what's happened to her two best friends. And she has to keep thinking, she's got this baby at home. She's got to go back and feed this bloody baby all the time. I mean, what was I thinking? And so George is going to be in the same situation now, probably. So, yeah. Nannies are for that, yes. Good idea. We'll get a nanny a couple of books down the right. Queen. Yeah, but what's that?
I said Queenie can be.
Queenie can be the nanny. Oh God, can you imagine?
That's a really horrible idea.
Yeah, I could just see that. You know, Queenie, where's the baby? Yeah. Yeah. That's another interesting thing. World War II, because this is a light series, a light-hearted series, we're skirting around some more serious things already. So that fine balance between being humorous and then dealing with situations that, you know, are really not in any way funny. On the other hand, since Darcy will obviously be involved in some sort of espionage, Would Georgie get involved in that? Would Mummy be stuck in Germany? We'll have to see. I mean, I'm taking things slowly. You know, we've got to have the birth of this baby. We've got to find a nanny. So we can do, we can, well, oh, and
got,
also.
You've got 3 years to go.
Yeah, and the king has got to abdicate. And you know, there's got to be the coronation of the next king and queen. So we've got all these nice things first. But it will be interesting when we get to the war, how closely I would want to touch that. And, you know, when you're getting England being bombed, and perhaps I can string it out so that I will just retire gracefully before that happens.
Well, here's the great thing. When you're writing historical fiction, everybody's already dead, right? Today.
Yeah.
So you don't have to age them in real time. You can finish in April and May and then start another case
in June. Actually, the book I've just started, which is called The Proof of the Pudding, starts right after one stops. So, I should string it out slowly.
You can.
The only thing is, can you imagine, poor Georgie, I mean, if you think about, if you were her friend and somebody dies every 2 months, you probably wouldn't want to go to dinner with her.
Good point.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that would be an interesting thing too, wouldn't it? That would, although, yeah.
Well, you'd have to moor her, the person who actually owns Ainslie, somewhere in South America, or...
Oh, no, he'd probably be involved in some sort of noble acts to do with the war.
But they'd have to keep the house.
Yeah. Georgie and Darcy collect Social Security. They moved to
plot.
Sun City.
Right.
Do I ever get writer's block? You know, I don't have time really, because I'm doing one of the Georgies a year. I'm doing one of the big standalones a year, and I'm doing half of the Molly Murphy with Claire. So there is no time for writer's block. You know, if there's one day I'm not writing, I think, oh God, I'm behind this month. Obviously, writing, some days go really smoothly, you know, and I rush ahead and the scene's good, and I call out to John, hey, listen to what Queenie just said, and we laugh. Other days it's not easy. It's just the same as any other profession, you know. Some days I get up, I walk around, I get a cup of coffee, I throw things in the washer and the dryer, I walk around the garden a few times, but I give myself a number of words I have to do per day. And so if I don't do that number of words, then I can't leave. So I have to just keep working. And sometimes that takes me 4 or 5 hours. Sometimes it takes me 2 hours. It's just, you know, there's good days and bad days. Yes.
Do you handwrite, or are you?
Oh God. If you saw my handwriting, I would have written 1.5 books in the last 20 years. Oh yeah. I should tell you that this book is number 50 for me. Yes.
I didn't count. Yeah. Well, yeah. Congratulations. Yeah. Wow.
Yes, yeah. So that's a big milestone. And it would have been book number 2 if I'd handwritten, because sometimes I will wake in the night and I will think, oh, wait a minute, I don't think she would have said that. And I get the pad behind my bed and I write. And then in the morning it says, she slurdles, paddle, guddle. And I have no idea what it was. No. And the best thing that ever happened to me was when they invented computers, because I can now type as fast as I could think. You know, and on a typewriter, you had to go and things. So about 1,500, about 5 pages a day. I know if I do that, then I can finish a first draft in 3 months. And then I know that I have time to go through and you know, rewrite, polish, give it to people to read, and then it's done within the 6 months that I need. Although I have to slip in the other book now with Claire. That has to come in somewhere as well. So, the Georgies are between 80 and 90. The big books are about 120, and they're 400 and something pages. So, you know, they take much more research too. So, you know, they're a bigger challenge altogether.
But you like it.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, because I love all the research and everything. You know, I don't know, those of you who did you read Where the Sky Begins, the one that I wrote in yeah. I mean, that's interesting about what it was like to be bombed in London and be evacuated. And it really is the war on the home front for the first time for me.
I liked it because, you know, there's a tendency to think that maybe it was a glamorous time or something. And really, the day-to-day life, people barely had anything interesting to eat. You know, it was hard to stay clean because, you know, soap was...
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the only other book I ever read that made me realize that was Enigma by Robert Harris.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, yeah. And he talked about everybody was gray and dirty.
Yeah.
You know, there was no dry cleaning. There was no...
No.
I mean, you know, it was...
Yeah.
And, you know, the problem in part is the sort of the thing we're looking at today. England had outsourced so many things that when the war happened and the supply chains all, you know, were compromised, even getting food became a problem. And you would think that we would have learned from that. But, you know, we've done the same.
No kidding.
We've done the same thing, you know, all over again. Why are we getting baby powder from China?
Yeah.
Or, you know, so.
Well, the worst one, I think, is that most of our medications come from China.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, your antibiotics, if that.
We don't have any control at all over what's going on. And, you know, that's part of the problem with book publishing is it was cheaper to print in China. And, you know, that's why so many books are delayed or, you know, they sell out and then the publisher can't go back to press fast enough. And so we can't supply them to you. Yeah. I never know for sure when I send out the calendar like I did for you today that all of those things are really going to happen when I say. Uh-huh. Because, of, you know, especially with live events, if the books don't come. Yeah. You know, virtual events, it doesn't matter. We can do the virtual event and the books will eventually show up. So it's not nearly as time critical. But with more and more live events coming along, we do need to rely. There's one publisher who actually sent out a notice to bookstores saying, we can't promise you that the books for your event are going to be there. No. So it's making me very nervous about booking authors from this publisher because, you know, that's a real hassle.
Yeah, it is. Oh, any other questions? Yes.
When you're writing, like, how much do you sketch out in advance, like, and plan?
So there's two types of writers. There's either a plotter or a pantser. So you write by the seat of your pants. I'm much more a pantser, especially with Georgie, because I know what situation she's going to get herself into. I usually know who's going to die and why, but I don't know any of the details. And I like to be surprised. You know, when I write and someone says something that I hadn't expected, that's interesting. So, you know, if I'd outline, some people have a complete outline that they followed. By the time I'd finished that outline, I'd think, oh, good, that's that book's done. Let's go on to the next one. So I like to be surprised and I like to follow my characters rather than being the puppet master and making them do things. So, with the bigger books, you know, with the big standalones, there's a lot more structure, I think, because so much has to happen that I know this has to happen first and then that. I still like to have time to find out that perhaps this character can't get from A to B and perhaps this is going to happen and things. So, I have to tell you, every book that I've ever written, the first 50 pages are in absolute panic mode. I always think this time I'm going to say everything I want to say in 50 pages. It's going to be the shortest book ever. And then I go through, this is awful, this is rubbish. You know, nobody's going to like this one. And then by page 100, I sort of can see the way ahead thinking, oh, well, this is panning out okay. And then by page 200, I know where I'm going. So, but every book has to work like that for me, I think.
So the big standalones, part of the reason they're historical is because you do like to do the research?
Oh, I love the research. You know, there's so many things you find out as you go along. The one that I'm just finishing up now, I've got the first draft has gone to my editor, so I'm waiting for her notes. But it's about a woman whose various bad things happen to, but she's sent She's sent to France to be a courier, and she's taking notes from the radio operator to the resistance. And so one of the things I did, first of all, I read various books written by people that this had happened to. There's some of them who lived to 90 after all this, you know, having been captured, tortured, and God know what, and they survived. But one of the things I read was exactly what their training schedule was, and that was fascinating, the whole things they went through. You know, when they were up in Scotland and they had to learn how to scale a cliff and then how to come up behind someone and slit their throat quietly, and, you know, things like this that you'd never think of. And there's one scene in which she's right before they go to France, they have to come up with a complete persona. They have to come up with their backstory about everything about them. And they have to be that person all the time while they're training. And her real name is Madeline. And she's walking across, you know, she's not in class. She's walking across the campus and someone says, "Hey, Madeline." And she turns around and he slaps her face and nearly knocks her over. And he says, "You just signed your death warrant." So you suddenly realize how very serious it was. In fact, their survival rate was 25%. And yet people kept volunteering. And that was the other thing in the book I just written, the one about Where the Sky Begins, about the bomber pilots. Their survival rate was 50%. And yet they got new recruits all the time. So just amazing.
It is. Well, you know, especially the young have a capacity for believing that they're immortal or it won't happen to them.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah.
You can see, but yes, it was incredibly brave.
Yeah.
Was there another question? You're looking poised.
This is a lively virtual audience.
Oh, I could do. Yeah, so Belinda has an admirer who is a count called Louis Philippe, they take a picnic to near the Eiffel Tower, and yes, so at the Eiffel Tower, so incredibly tall and beautiful. I must have given a little gasp. "It is rather impressive, I agree," Belinda said. "Do you know they were going to pull it down?" Louis Philippe says, turning back to me. "They built it for the great exhibition, and it was the plan to pull it down afterwards. Everyone thought it was an iron monstrosity, but it survived." And we'll move on to that. "Where do you plan to sit?" Louis Philippe asked. "Here will do perfectly," Belinda went to spread out the rug. "You plan to sit on the grass?" Louis Philippe sounded horrified. "But it is damp. It will give you a chill." "Nonsense, it hasn't rained for days," Belinda said. "And the rug is thick. Come on, sit down." "But I shall get grass stains on my trousers," he said, "and the creases will be ruined, and your dress. It will expose your knees, I think." "Don't be such a fuddy-duddy," Belinda said. "What is this fuddy-duddy?" "A stick in the mud." "Where is this mud?" he said, looking around nervously. "I do not have a stick with me." And we both chuckled. He looked hurt, and Belinda explained it was an English expression. "Very silly, these English expressions," he commented. I have to skip ahead a bit. He takes Georgie up to the top of the Eiffel Tower, or up to the next layer. And then when they're up there, "My gaze moved down to the Seine below us, the river busy with pleasure boats on a Sunday afternoon. On the quayside, I spotted a man with a bald head, poring over a large map. As I focused on him, he approached a passing stranger, pointing at the map. The man stopped obligingly and pointed out a route. The first man nodded and thanks and set off. The other man watched him for a minute before turning away. From this height, it was impossible to see faces, but I could have sworn that the man who gave the directions was Darcy.
Luis Felipe is a cad. I'm just going to tell you right now.
Any more questions? Yeah.
Well, then maybe it's time for champagne.
Yeah, there is. Right? There is champagne.
We have champagne.
There are macarons.
Oh,
champagne.
Wonderful.
Oh, we should.
Oh,
yes.
Good point, Claire.
Good point, Claire.
You're catching on to this whole promotion thing really well.
Yeah.
So this is Claire Broyles, who is Reese's daughter and is now the author, along with Reese, of the Molly Murphy series. Look at that, an advanced reading copy. Why don't I have one of those, I have to ask.
Yeah.
So tell us briefly.
It means I have to think about something. So this one, we did a lot of research into Tammany Hall and into the mechanisms of politics in New York City at that time. And so Bridie is now going to school along with a rather wealthy young lady. They've become best friends. And then intrigue strikes that young lady's family, and Molly has to help solve that mystery.
Yeah, we also did a lot of research into how the docks worked and the whole mechanism of who was a stevedore and who wasn't,
on the waterfront.
On the waterfront,
without Marlon Brando,
and the incredible amount of corruption at the docks too,
which was
all tied into Tammany Hall. And we have a mayor's election between the Tammany Hall candidate and William Randolph Hearst.
That'd be fascinating.
So he comes into the book quite a lot too. So there's another
job that, you know, think about it today. It's all container ships. I mean, I have sat and watched. It's all cranes and container ships, that whole for centuries, stevedores, you know, people who move cargo on and off boats, all automated now. And I read the other day that robots may soon invade your home. Instead of, you know, a cleaning staff, you may get a robot or something.
We both have one. You have the little Roomba, and it goes around.
You got one more question? I see you over there chortling. No?
Yes.
All right.
Well, yes.
How did that come about?
Well, it's a really nice story that the guy they chose for the very first cover did a drawing of Lady Georgie, and they accepted it. And it turns out, you know, half the year we live near San Francisco. And turns out he lives in San Francisco. So he came to my first book signing and said, I'm John Matos. And he's quite a famous designer, actually. And he brought me a wonderful book that he's in part of a book on sort of modern designers. And anyway, so each of the covers now, I say what I want on the cover. He does a sketch. We had lots of backwards and forwards on that because the first one I thought was way too busy, and I wanted it to show that it was in maybe Chanel in a workroom of some sort, but he had too many bolts, so we gradually sort of cropped it till we got what we wanted. But each of the covers, I really say exactly what I want, and I get the sketch. And then the nicest thing, he brought me as a present once the original sketch of Georgie signed and framed. So that's really nice. Yeah. No, I've been very lucky with covers because I've nearly always had, apart from the original paperbacks of the Constable Evans series, which I can hardly remember what they look like. They all had some farm animal on the cover. You know, they had, you know, Evans so-and-so, and there's a goat, and Evans so-and-so, there's three sheep. And I was talking to the audience once, and I said, well, I've just been given the Old MacDonald Award. And everybody applauded, and I said, it's for the most farm animals on covers.
I love it. Well, thank you all very much for coming this evening. Let's congratulate Reese on her 50th book.
Yeah.
Wow. So normally I give a book away, but tonight I'm actually going to give away the flowers. So you want to pick, Amy, are you up there? Okay. You have to be here to win, but would you like to pick a number between 1 and 21? You have to have 14 in your book, and if whoever's 14 isn't here, they lose out. There should be a little ticket in your book with a number on it. No 14? Oh, there you are. Sure. Wonderful. All right. You may want to tip the water down somewhat. But anyway, thank you all so much for coming. If you'll fold up your chairs and lean them up there against that. And Reese can actually, would you rather sit at the little table? Okay. Reese is going, so we'll go backwards. She's going to sit at the little round table back there so you can line up by number in front of her and get your book signed. Today is Dia de los Muertos, so maybe it was a good day for a mystery conversation, right? So have a wonderful evening, the rest of it. Thanks again.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.